Hi, and welcome to the Terra Nullius Cyprus podcast. I'm Costa Constanti, and with me today, I have a very special lady from Australia, somebody who I've only just recently met in person, and I've been following her for a little while now, but meeting her in person has certainly inspired me, impressed me, and made me think things that I didn't know I had thought of before. I want to welcome to the program Helena Kidd, all the way over from Melbourne. Welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure, Costa. Thank you for having me here.
No, it's absolutely my pleasure. For those listening, just in recent days, Helena Kidd has won the award for literature at the Cyprus Diaspora Forum. It was held in Limassol from the 6th to the 9th of March. It was a forum where Cypriots and immigrants in Cyprus, so Cypriots from around the world and immigrants in Cyprus got together. It was a business to business. It was culture to culture. It was all different variations of industries gathering, the creme de la creme of our global community. And one of them certainly was Helena Kidd, amongst other writers that were there. And I kind of spoiler alert, I just mentioned writers, so I guess we'll just dive straight into it. Helena, you won the award because of your books that you've written, in primarily the first book you wrote, but you've now written a second one. What's the name of the first book, the title?
The first book is When the Past Awakens, and the second book was written and got published just a few weeks before I actually came to the conference. So I was really pleased to actually be able to bring the second book with me. Mm-hmm. And it's called When the Past is Left, a companion to the first book, When the Past Awakens.
I'm certainly looking forward to reading it, and I can't thank you enough for your gift of the book. So I have it. I've got my own signed copy. It's quite an honor, because I know from the little bit that I know about it, what an effort it was for you and what a journey it was for you to put this into words, to print. Let's take a step back, actually. So because for people listening, they won't know what the story is. Tell me how it began. Like, it all began with your mother. Let's go. What is your mother's name?
Maria Avram.
Maria Avram from?
From Scarino, Larnaca.
Scarino, Larnaca. Okay. So, and she went to Melbourne. So I'll let you tell the story. I'm not going to tell this. Sorry, I'm jumping in. I'm really excited for your story to get shared. Okay. So tell me the story about your mother and how it led to this book.
Okay. The story about my mother is that she came to Australia in 1957. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to actually give away too much, because mm-hmm. then we'll give away the whole story.
Yeah.
But my mother came to Australia as one of the last persons from the family. She came with my younger uncle, mm-hmm. and she came by aeroplane, one of the first to travel by aeroplane to Cyprus. Mm-hmm. It took quite a few days to get here. And when she arrived, my father was already here.
Okay,
and I won't say much more, but my father was here for many years, and I'll go into explaining that a lot of the men mm-hmm. from Cyprus and all the small villages came to Australia and then sent for their wives or mm-hmm. sent for their betrothed or yep. had a Brooks and Yore with a photo and sent for them. My mother was waiting in Cyprus for six long, long years, and my father never sent for her.
In Cyprus, yeah.
Yeah, in Cyprus. And because she was married, she was like a slave. My grandmother was a tyrant. She was very demanding, and my mother felt like a slave in the village, mm-hmm. especially after she got married. So she finally came out, and her first night in Australia was spent in hospital. And that's because of my father, and that's all I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. But then all she wanted was to have children, and her dream was to have children. So she had three children, which I'm the first, my brother, and then my sister. And then what happened, we lived in the Richmond house, and I've written that at the back of the book of When the Past Awakens. I give my account of my mother's story in mm. my own words. I basically fill in the gaps. We lived in a house like a lot of other migrants where They come out from Cyprus and many families are living in the same house, sometimes yep. one whole family in one room. Yep. So we were living with my uncles, my cousins and other people coming from Cyprus. So that was my life as I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of recollection of that, but I thought it was fine because we had all our cousins with us. But it was pretty, pretty congested. And after that... my mother finally, and it's in the book again, moved and bought her own house in Brunswick. And the whole story of that is in the book. Now, I found my mother's diaries a few years later. Now, when she went to Brunswick, she started writing and put her story on the page in an A-form diary. Now, I have to say that she is quite amazing because when I write, I'm writing on a computer.
Yeah,
and I put it out there and I rewrite it and I rewrite it and I edit and I edit and I edit and I try and make the sentence beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother wrote straight on to the paper, beautiful sentences, the whole story, like she was writing a novel.
Did she write in Greek or English?
She wrote in Greek.
Okay.
And I found that diary and I said to her, Mitera dinafto, gemulei in a storia mu.
So he said, Mother, what is this? And she says, it's my story.
And I can't read it. I'm finished. I'm done. So she basically used that as therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So a few years later, then I got it translated from Greek to English. When I got that translation, I lay in bed when I lived in Warrandyte and I read it. And I read it the whole night through.
And that was the first time you were reading
first it? First time I read it. And I was bawling my eyes out, literally streaming mm-hmm. tears down because what my mum hid from us, her children... was amazing, and I didn't know anything about her life. She was one of those Greek women that just was stoic.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's inside. I come across as strong and I can cope. But inside she was basically a mess, trembling. She suffered from depression mm-hmm. that I didn't know about. We didn't use that word back then.
No.
So I read it. The next day I sent her a bunch of flowers. It's making me emotional just talking about it. And then again, some years went by and 10 years even, and I decided I need to get this story out to the wider world.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, with my mother's permission to reveal her mystica, her secrets, and I want to thank her from the bottom of my heart that she actually gave me that permission to tell her secrets, because women of her age take those secrets to their graves. And with their last breath, those secrets are gone, because who's going to tell them after that?
It's a common story that permeates through migrant communities back in the old days and even today. I mean, here in Cyprus, we have a lot of Syrian families coming in, a lot of African families coming in. And exactly how you described your mother's story just briefly there, I see this today where a lot of women are suffering either from domestic abuse or domestic violence or just literally being ostracized by the community or their own family. And like you just said, the inner power of women surprises and impresses me, where they're able to stand stoic, as you said, deliver the meals to the kids, go to work if they're working
yes.
or run a household, and bottle it all up
mm.
with the lack of freedoms, with a lack of pleasure and joy in life. I guess that your mother and these other mothers and women that I talk about maybe get a bit of pleasure watching their kids grow up. Not all of them have kids, of course. However, that pain is something that no one deserves. No one deserves. Your mum in particular, what impresses me the most is that she had the emotional intelligence, if that's the word for it, to actually sit and write these things. As you said, it was perhaps a form of therapy. We have all these, like, you know, experts on journaling and all this now.
Mm.
You know, we're in the 2000s.
Yes.
And we're only just starting to discover this form of therapy. And there's your mum.
Correct.
You know, doing it before bread was sliced, you know.
Mm.
Writing it down in a foreign country, with the experience that she's experienced, with the weight of parenthood on her shoulder, motherhood on her shoulder, to be more specific in this case, writes it down, but not only writes it down, allows you to read it.
Correct.
And then, and this is the bit that just blows my mind, permitted you to go public with it. For me, that is the most brave part of it all.
To me, that is the most brave part, exactly as you said.
Yeah.
And I must say that I actually grew up without a father. Mm-hmm. My mother was pregnant with my sister and our father deserted us.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I won't go into that, but
my
mother never talked to me about our father.
Mm-hmm.
She sat me down one day when I was a teenager and said, Eleni, I will let you know why you don't have a father.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't give me the whole story at all. It was only till I read that story when she was in her 70s, nearly 80s, that's when I've read her story. So when I'm a teenager, I know nothing.
Yeah.
And she's too ashamed to tell me that what happened and never tells me. She wears her wedding band the whole time because she's also ashamed of not having a father as we grow up with my uncles and aunties. She'd go to work with her wedding band and tell people
that
he was, that she's married and he was away.
It's indignant. It signifies the society that she lived in where there was a shame at being a divorcee or an abandee or a widower even, you know.
Correct.
Unfortunately, this still permeates. This still exists in today's society. People are still... They're divorcephobic, or they're scared to walk away from toxic relationships.
Correct.
They're scared to walk away from violence, from toxicity, from negligence. And in your mother's generation, tenfold harder.
Unheard of. They stayed till the very end. And when the husband died, if they were an abusive husband, like my dad was, they celebrated their death because finally they were free.
They were liberated. Yet that celebration was in private.
It was in private, correct, absolutely.
At best, they may have had one best friend that they may have confided in.
Correct.
But in general, you're right, they would mourn, they'd wear the black, probably for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
They would have a public front that was one of a mourner.
Mm-hmm.
They would never remarry.
Never
date again. I mean, let's go down. Let's put for a moment to the side a terrible relationship. Let's talk about a good relationship. When a happily married couple, when one dies, that generation did not remarry in general. We're stereotyping it now, but in general, they would not remarry because it was that shame of you're married. Yes, till death do us part, but even in death, they would still not remarry. There was a shame of how, especially the women.
Yes.
You know, how can you ever look at another man? You know, the shame of it. And so they were, for the rest of their life, and especially when they were widowed young. Think about all the widows from World War I, World War II, and let's use Cyprus as an example, from the violence in the 60s, the war in 74, so many widowed women.
Correct, yes.
Cursed for the rest of the... Blessed perhaps with a happy marriage memory, but cursed for the rest of their life, not being able to find happiness again in a partner.
Yeah.
Not saying that that's the only way to find happiness, don't get me wrong. I mean, people are happy sometimes to be on their own. But a lot of them do want somebody in their life.
Yeah, generally that's what happened. And it actually, even though my father deserted us, I tell my mother, because she felt guilty that we didn't have a father.
Yeah.
So as I'm growing up, I'm telling my mother, it's the best thing that happened. We wouldn't be the human beings we are today if we lived in a toxic family, in a toxic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So she finally got that at the end of her life. She realised that it was better for us not to have...
I was going to ask you if she realised that.
Yeah, and she, of course, she was never going to marry. She didn't want to. She had a bad relationship. She didn't want... You know, there were good men out there, but she didn't feel she needed anyone in her life. Her main focus was to raise her children.
I was saying perhaps she felt satisfied with her happiness in life, having three kids to tend to.
Correct, yeah.
So you were seven. No, how old were you when your father left?
I was three.
You were three. So you did not grow up with him.
Yeah, and my sister was still not born.
So, knowing what I know about the guy, he doesn't realize he did this, but he did you a favor.
He did us a favor.
Did you a big favor. And I can tell you that wasn't the reason why he did it. But no, he didn't do it to do you a favor.
But I had to convince my mum that's the outcome.
It's sad that you've got to convince her, though.
Yeah, I had to convince her. And there is one funny thing. When she gave me permission to tell her story, I actually got her to sign a piece of paper. So I've got that piece of paper with her name on it because I just wanted to prove, if anyone asked me, that I have got permission.
And again, that's indicative of the world we live in where there's going to be doubt thrown on you. How else would you know these stories if she hasn't shared them with you? Mm-hmm. And the fact that the book was published, and I'm so happy to hear that it made it in time before your mother passed. How long before?
I write in the second book when the past is left. The second book is a companion to the first book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's people that read the first book and my editor who read the first book, who was editing the second book, said to me, Helena, I'm so happy that you've written the second book. I wanted more of Maria. I wanted more of her. So I've basically filled in the gaps. I've also put a story in of my son's because he writes at the back how he lived with Yaya, how he suffered back pain from an accident. My mother suffered back pain. So I've written a whole chapter on my son and I've explained that whole chapter in our lives where I'm caring for my mother and I'm caring for my son.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to your original question, Mum got to hold Maria Avraham got to hold her book in her hands with its Victorian Community History Award, which we forgot to mention.
Sorry, that's on me. That's absolutely on me.
Well, we're mentioning the Cypress Award.
I'm more up to date.
I just thought I'd better mention.
I'm glad you did because
quite funny because that story is quite amazing too because we did the book and then someone said, "Oh, you got to take it to the Richmond Historical Society because we lived in Richmond." So we took a copy there. The president. David Langdon said, "Oh, you've got to take it to the Royal Historical Society." And again, I write this in the second book. So I take it there and they go, or I ring them and they say, "Bring some copies and three for the awards." And I go, "Okay, I'll bring three for the awards. What awards are these?" So I'm Googling what these awards are. I'd never heard of them. Anyway, I take the books and then it's in COVID. We get shortlisted and there's entrance. So many entrants in community diversity, and there's we're in a category of five. We don't win, which is fine, but we get recognised and we get the Victorian Community History Awards sticker on our book. So Mum gets to hold the book with a sticker on it, and she goes, "Dinafto, what's this?" And I said, "We've been recognised." She goes, "I didn't write the book for that." I said, "I know that, Mum, but we've been recognised." So she was holding her book, and I did tell her not to die. I said, "Remember, Thandi, until I've published your book." And she didn't. And
that's a good way to keep someone alive.
Yeah, I said, "Mum, you and she was, I could tell she was getting old. She was shrinking. She was eating less. I've written all that in the second book too because the second book's about grief.
Yes.
It's about losing a parent. And I think people will relate to that. But it's a lot more. It's about love. But Mum passed away 8 months later.
Mm-hmm.
On the 21st of the 11th, 2021. And she held on just long enough so we could have a funeral with people, any numbers, that COVID law or was lifted and we could have as many people as we wanted at the funeral. Yep. So she also had held on for that.
I've got the reverse version of that story with my grandfather. Oh. I think he chose to go during the lockdowns because he was as popular a man as he was and as well-known as he was, and I know very well that his funeral would have been attended by the huge masses. He was a very...
private?
He was very social, very comic. He was always out there. But I know that he would have been thrilled knowing that there was only 10 people at his funeral. But that's my grandfather.
Yes.
So, I'm so glad to hear that your mother, you guys made it to have a proper funeral.
We had a lot of people come from the past.
Yes.
Because even my brother's friends, my friends, when we lived in Richmond, Mum welcomed everyone into the house. It was one of those pop-in houses. And even the Brunswick house was a pop-in house, which you could just pop in any time. But that doesn't seem to be the case these days.
No, this style has disappeared with when, as everyone needs to work now, like you don't have any more
time,
for lack of a better description, the housewife that was at home, the mother that was like, you know, the father would go and work and the mother would be at home and all the kids would be there with all their friends dropping in. That world has changed. Good in one sense, because it's good to see women in the workforce, whatever. But unfortunately, the open house, vegging out in the evening with friends, that's gone. And I see that here in Cyprus, that the sitting around at the cafenet or at a house in the village with lots of people hanging around to the late hours talking seems to have gone. I can't pinpoint exactly what it is. It can't just be because people are working, because people have always worked. I think it's the digital era. People are more online now. People move away from their homes much easier now than they did in the past.
And I think it's the following generations. When I came to Cyprus in the first time when my yaya and bapu were living here, it was 1978. And I remember going to the my mum's house, my yaya's house in the village. And I think it was before sunset, maybe 2 hours before, the village ladies would come with their crochet. And they'd sit around, they'd make coffee, and we'd sit with them too, because I was with my cousins then. And I've at the village now, this is 2024, and there's my village in Skarino now is a is a heritage listed traditional village. And there's all tourists there. You might find a few. I mean, there are definitely locals there. But it's lost its past. It's gone.
Well, it's also, even those that perhaps do live there, it's become like a commuter town. So basically people would jump in their car, the highway is literally meters away. They jump on the highway and off they go to Limassol, Larnaca or Nicosia for work. They don't come back till the evening, where they just go straight into their homes for their meals and go to sleep. So the village has kind of died in a way.
It has, it has.
And I think, I do think there's a glimmer of hope, because with the digital nomads now, with working remotely, with, you know, basically being able to work remotely, communicate with your colleagues and your clients and your managers or whatever, and stay at home, I do believe we're going to see a resurgence of these villages. And again, with even with tourists like taking up some of the rooms, you're going to have locals that are working remotely and everything that comes with that, you know, the kids, the schools are going to have to get reactivated. Because I've, for the first time in Bafos, in rural Bafos, I saw a new an old primary school reopened.
Oh, good news.
Because, yeah, it partly had to do with digital nomads and their kids, but also because of migrant kids. So the population of youth went up. So that's a positive sign. Now, I don't know how sustainable it is. The pandemic drove that catalyst forward. It woke the world up to remote working and how to utilize the technology we have today. That, I think, is going to bring us back to this village mentality. You know, you close the laptop at 5 o'clock and then go sit in the cafe. I'm hoping that's going to happen.
Same here. You just woken something up in me. I'm in the village, in my mum's Skarino village, and I just realized I haven't seen a child. I haven't seen a child running around. Whereas when I came in 78, there were so many children.
There were children everywhere.
And then I came in 2016 and 17. What I've purposely done is sought out the old yaya. And I saw one walking down the street and I immediately stopped her. Now, we've had a chat already, and I've only been there since the 10th of this month. And we've had a chat. She's popped in and visited me. And this morning I happened to be just walking up and around the hills and I saw her in her house. And I came in and we had a chai, a herbal tea, and she gave me some halloumi and some bread this morning. So I'm actually
recreating the old world in a way. Well, the new world perhaps. Well, I'll tell you another story. In my father-in-law's village, Peristerona in rural Bafos, because of business, I spent a few days working remotely there. And the house is in the village square, basically. And I could hear after school hours all these kids outside playing football, soccer, and they're kicking the ball around and they're all talking to each other in Greek, and it's like fluent Cypriot dialect Greek, okay? They're playing. I thought, this is so nice. So I went out and I'm looking at them and they look like us, you know, and they're, like, and they're playing. And I hear one of the kids saying, Mohammed, kick the ball. All right. And they're using all these names that are not Greek Orthodox names. And I asked one of them, gone, what did you say his name was? And he goes, Muhammad. I go, oh, where is he from? Syria. Where are you from? Syria. This group of kids, there was about 7, 8 of them playing football. They were all Syrian. Each and every one of them was Syrian, speaking fluent Greek, had totally integrated with the village. I found out later, because I looked into it, their parents are integrated in the village. They're living as Cypriots, basically. There's new Cypriots in the village. The parents, the reason why they're in the village is, one, because it's cheaper, mm-hmm. two, because they're rural workers, they're in the fields. And I thought to myself, you know, we talk so negatively about immigration, but these kids
have integrated.
They have literally, though, reinvigorated the village. They've brought life back into the village.
Is there a program to bring them into these villages? I don't know.
There isn't. And Cyprus is light years behind when it comes to that. Yeah. Don't think of your...
Australia.
I worked at Yarra City Council in Melbourne, in Richmond, with integration programs of migrants. So believe me, we're nowhere near that yet in Cyprus. It's happening organically, which is good in one way, but it does need state support. But you, speaking of the village, your family in the house in Richmond, mm-hmm. uncles, aunties, cousins, everyone living, as we say in Greek, everyone together, okay, all on top of each other. As a child, that would have seemed normal to you, right?
Correct.
It's a case of none the wiser. It was more normal back then as well because, I mean, there was many migrant communities living in share housing. And we see it today with new migrants, like the Sudanese, for example, in Melbourne.
Yes.
You know, the share housing. We forget that this was such commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was good or not is another story. I mean, there is that good thing about it takes a village to raise a child, so I'm sure the uncles and aunties and everyone were contributing.
That's right.
There is also the negative where there is no privacy for a couple. I mean, you can imagine a married couple having their in-laws and, you know, siblings and, everyone in the same house. Not fun. But it must have helped you form bonds, though, with the other members of the family, no?
It did. I mm-hmm. grew up without a father. Mm-hmm. The shoe shop was at the front, so my uncles were sangaris, mm-hmm. Shoe merchants or shoe repairers or mm-hmm. shoemakers. And it gave me a chance to have male role models in my life. So yep. I take it from that perspective that I had role models, good yep. role models yep. in my life.
Mm-hmm.
We did move I write this in yep. my section of the first book, When the Past Awakens. We did move rooms very, very often because mm-hmm. a new arrival would come and then they'd put them in the bigger room, or if someone had a baby, they'd yeah. move us into the other room. So we kept moving rooms, which was fine because to me it was normal.
Yeah.
But I do...
And it was normal.
It was normal.
It was normal.
But yeah. I do feel that a lot of the next generation, the third generation of Cypriots and even just Australians of younger generations, they can't afford to buy houses like we used to in Australia. And I know for a fact, and I know people that are doing share houses, they're buying a house.
Yeah.
For them to afford the mortgage, they're doing a share house.
Yep.
So that idea of the past is basically repeating. Happening now.
Yeah.
'Cause my daughter, when she left school and left home, she went into a share house
mm-hmm.
and lived with many people. And then... obviously, she was lucky enough she went off and bought her own house. Yeah. So there are so many people that are doing that today as well.
It's interesting because, this share housing concept. I think the difference, though, is that in the older days...
It was family.
It was family or new migrants of the same community, yes. for example. Now it's share housing either with friends...
Yeah, or strangers.
Or absolute strangers or colleagues even, you know. Mm. And that doesn't tend to have the sustainability, longevity of the previous version of
correct,
share housing.
Yeah.
And again, there's pros and cons. The cons are that, you know, relationships can fall apart, there can be hostilities, it can fail. Mm. The positive is that you have your privacy. You know, you close your door, no one's seeking you, no one's expecting you to cook for them or whatever. You mentioned earlier your mother moved from Richmond and bought a place in Brunswick. How did she buy the place?
Again, it's in there, but mm-hmm. she was 64.
Mm-hmm.
She was just maybe working a couple of hours a week in a nursing home, making tea and coffee for mm-hmm. the elderly. And the way she bought a house was that she saved some money.
Yep.
She was putting a lot of money away in a bank book in our names. And it was going to be our money, and we said that we don't want the money. And then she had an idea to buy a house and use that as a deposit. Now, the banks weren't going to lend her any money at that age.
Mm.
So the three of us children went as her guarantors, and we helped her buy a house. And that's a house in Brunswick, and that's in the second book called When the Past is Left.
Mm-hmm.
And she called it her quiet house because that's where she went and wrote her story and had peace and quiet because she wasn't in the busy house in Richmond anymore with our grandparents.
Yeah.
And my grandfather passed away, and then we brought my yaya back to the Richmond house.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that story of the battle between my mother and her own mother is in there. And like I said, my mother felt like she was being belittled, mentally abused, but that word wasn't a word back then.
No.
By my grandmother.
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't acknowledge the physical or mental violence or abuse from women to women.
Correct. So that's definitely highlighted.
Yep.
My mother highlights that continuously throughout the story. Yeah. Throughout the story.
Because I do wonder, your grandmother, the tyrant, as you said, I wonder how much, I mean, I don't want to give her a carte blanche now. I don't want to let
No.
her, but I do wonder how much of that is the society that she was brought up in, where she herself feared the repercussions of being more warmer to her daughter or allowing her daughter to be liberal. Or, you know, I wonder how much of that was, my daughter needs to follow in my footsteps of being abused, you know, of being abused or being a hard worker and just being at the mercy of my husband or sons or whatever.
I think my grandmother, and you've got to remember that generation was born in the 1800s, that they didn't know any better.
Yeah.
And I feel that my grandmother felt she needed to, in some ways, even though she was mentally abusing, and she did physically abuse my mother, there's a little section where my mother went to play with a friend and came back and got the xylo, got hit till she was black and blue. My mother doesn't write any more about that, but I know that there were more times.
Yeah.
So she's never told me any more than this, maybe a sentence. But I feel that generation didn't know any better. They were brought up in that way, and I feel that my grandmother needed to assert her power.
Yeah.
Whether that power was abuse, but she needed to assert power to say, I'm a strong woman. And I think that's where it comes from, but the wrong power.
Yeah, you just stole the words from another. The wrong power. It's, I'm trying to assert power to control you or keep you in line or keep you in the check of the normalities of the society I lived in or grew up in. And unfortunately, that generation, and even to this day, it exists where it's just they go about it all the wrong way. Your grandfather, tell me a little bit about him.
Good one. Mm. We need to talk about him because my grandfather was wonderful. My grandfather used to bring my mother books to read, and from the library in, so I don't know where he got the books in the village, but my mother talks highly of my grandfather. And in the village, when I went back now, even generations later, they know him as Mastro Yorgo, Maestro George. Yeah. And he was the one who bought books to my mother, who read books. And I think that's where she got her passion, not only for reading, but learned how to write.
I wonder.
So he was a great man.
Sounds like he was a good role model as well,
he
bringing
was.
Education to women, which again, unheard of in that generation. Which, your mother was married before your father left Cyprus, right?
She was married before, she was married for a very short time.
Yep, then he up and left.
Up and left.
Yep. So by being married, she's been locked into this whirlpool, no way out. Was her marriage arranged?
It was arranged 100%
yep.
Against her will.
Yep. Who do you think led that?
It was my grandmother.
Yep.
It was also the other side of the family. But again, we can't blame them because that's how things were back then. And my mother has forgiven her own mother. But it was also led by what Brika, what we could give in a dowry to the marriage. And then my father was more demanding, wanted more and more. Because my mum was 28, 27 years old, and she was considered an old maid, in the old words, old maid. No one was going to marry her because she was old. And they thought past the age of having children, but she ended up having children at 36.
It's hard to imagine today saying that someone 27 is too old.
Is too old.
I mean, like we're reaching that stage now where we actually have the reverse issue that we've got women now freezing their eggs because they're not getting married till their 40s.
Exactly.
I mean, biology is biology. That we can't change at the moment. But it just, I mean, my grandmother had her first child at 16.
That is...
Yeah, which back then was incredibly common.
But there's still today, there's a few countries that are still doing arranged marriages to young women.
Look, I must admit, I'm happy for my grandparents because this is my mum's side of the family.
Yes.
My grandparents, it is a true love story.
That's
they had fallen in love. They had begged the community to allow them to marry. Because they were urban Nicosians, they were a little bit more modern and contemporary, so they actually were being refuted at the time. Sorry, my grandfather was in love with us, I should clarify, but modern cosmopolitan places. So they were reluctant to permit the wedding until my grandmother fell pregnant. Then it was, well,
we better get married.
You must get married now. To their pleasure, because they were like, that's what we've been trying to do.
So like, but that's a lovely story. That is a beautiful story. And I'm sure there's more stories like that.
Of course, there's plenty. And look, and I must admit, my grandparents are great role models. My grandfather worshipped the ground my grandmother walked on.
That's beautiful.
Until the end. He died late 2020. My grandma's still around. I'm going to see her in a couple of weeks.
Lovely.
It is a true love story. My grandfather did get difficult in the end, some form of dementia or whatnot. And yes, my grandmother used to be frustrated and everybody, you could see that she loved the pants off him. You know?
Yeah, beautiful.
But I can see other couples at that generation that, it is a relationship of necessity. When I say necessity, not because it is a necessity, but they believe it's a relationship of necessity where they stay together for way longer than they should or to the very end. Dragging misery along the way, passing on misery to their children and the community around them. What inspires me about your mum's story is that whilst she sucked it up and dealt with it and wasn't the one to leave your father, okay? And again, that is in no way insulting to her because it was definitely next to impossible to do back then. She kind of was blessed in the sense that he did eventually disappear. And that came at a heavy cost of you three not having a father. Granted, not going to be a great father, but, it's so many. I mean, everyone talks about the divorce rates are getting higher and higher. I come along and say, well, no, maybe people should get divorced when it's time.
Mm.
Perhaps before they get married, they should really seriously consider whether they should have got married in the first place. Exactly. That might help lower the divorce rate if that's what you're so concerned about. But, I mean... And I mean, I'm not even going to get into the different versions of marriages we have these days and all these controversies. Mm. At the end of the day, I always believe a child needs at least just one good role model. You said that you had your uncles and everything, but I honestly believe, without knowing your mother personally and as personally as I got to know her through your writing, I think your mother was a good role model.
Mm.
Having met you in person, you've come out all right.
Thank you.
And having met your son, Leon, he seems to have come out all right as well. And I mean, can I talk a little bit about Leon?
Yeah, he came as soon as he heard I was being invited on the literature panel.
Mm-hmm.
He straight away said, I'm coming. And I did want to bring him to Cyprus anyway, but...
Yeah.
We just moved the dates and the years more forward and he made sure he had time off. So I believe that, and my daughter would have come, but for financial reasons she couldn't and she would have come as well. But so I'm so proud of him that he came and...
How old is Leon?
He's 34.
Leon is 34 and Calandra, your daughter,
is 32.
32, okay. So and your son came, yes, yeah, sorry.
And he... I can feel how proud he is of me.
Mm.
And, yeah, he helped look after my mother.
Yes.
His Yaya. Mm. So he's very, very close to her. I also write in the second book and in the first book the time I gave him,
yes,
the story to read. And sometimes I look back and I've actually discussed this with him. I said, oh, you forgive me for giving you Yaya's story to read at this particular time. He was in hospital with excruciating back pain. And I rock up and I say, Leon, here's Yaya's story. I want you
here's
to read it.
Here's some more pain for you.
Yeah, and here's some more pain. Anyway, I don't know what came across me, but he said it was great for him
you
to be in.
You listen to your universe.
Yeah, I listen to the universe. Mm. And he said it was fantastic that I gave him the story. So I write that in the book too, that he read it and he had a new respect for his Yaya.
Yeah.
Even though he was in pain, he knew his pain one day, but it did take nearly 5 years with two operations to finally be pain-free. He knew and I knew in our hearts that his pain would go.
Yeah.
But his Yaya's pain was eternal.
Yeah.
Until the day she passed away, she suffered pain, back pain. So he, you know, he said that, no, I'm glad you gave me that story in the hospital that day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was crying.
The universe spoke to you and it delivered.
Yeah.
It delivered. Because, I mean, like, I dare say had you given it to him the day before, the day after, it may not have registered.
Yeah. And it was before the book was published as well. It was in copies. And the nurse came in, and I write this, saw him crying and go, and asked him, what are you crying? So he gave her the first three chapters to read to the nurse as well. So
look, this book, your mum's writing, your writing, for me, the most valuable part of it is not so much the recording of the history, but the message that it gives to women, but more importantly, the message it gives to men out there. Because a lot of men, whether it's a position of privilege, I acknowledge that, often just cannot comprehend the consequences of their behavior.
Mm.
Whether it's just gaslighting or ghosting or mental violence or physical violence, a lot of men don't realize the damage they're doing to their wives, to their partners, to their children, to the community around them. And whilst perhaps the men that really need to be targeted may not be reading this book, the people in their periphery, in their orbit, can identify things and call it out, say this is wrong,
correct,
this is not okay. I don't know if you remember those commercials in Australia where there were scenes where a guy, you know, walks up to another guy and says something derogatory about a woman.
They were great.
Yeah, yes, and instead of the second guy going, yeah, you know, look at her, ha ha, he turns around and put his arms out and go, no, that's not appropriate.
Yeah.
That I found empowering because it made my... I'm blessed by the universe to have already been, without being told to think a certain way, I think I've already been on that side of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that I have been validated and I can say no to somebody being sexist, racist, misogynist, hateful, phobic, whatever, you know. And I think that's what your book does.
Yeah, I hope so. And those ads were very powerful. Mm. And I think it takes an intelligent, powerful, confident male or female, because you can call it out on both sides.
Correct, correct.
To actually call it out.
Yeah.
And I think it's important. I have had male readers and, you know, they say justice has been shaken by your mother's story. Yeah. But I'd like more males to read it because these types of book tend to be female audience. My other audience I'd like to capture in these two books is the younger generation.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the younger third generation of Greeks, but the younger generation that are in their 20s, to read the stories of the past. You know, they might think, why do I need to know all this? But I think it's important that these stories are preserved and kept for prosperity and for the younger generations. Because if I didn't tell this story, I don't know who's going to tell a similar story to my mother's.
Yes.
Because I'm the second generation that is my mother's voice.
Yes.
I don't know that my daughter or my son would actually be telling my mother's story.
And then if society is to propel forward with corrections, things change. You know, the things that we witnessed in our grandparents and great-grandparents' generation, if you, Helena Kidd,
yes,
are not writing about it and sharing it, then we may very well be condemned to repeat it in different ways.
Yes.
Whether it's the gender pay gap, whether it's the, you know, the sexism in the office, whether it's, like we said, women treating women in a negative aspect, in a negative way, or shutting the door behind them when they're successful. You know,
I mean, I hate that.
Yeah, and I mean, your story, this story, is one of, you know, the violence and everything and the abuse.
But it's also about, there's the love. The love goes through the whole book.
Yes, and I mean, the fact that your mum, the fact that your mum was able to raise you and your brother and sister, then you were able to raise your son and daughter and instill on them certain values, certain templates and frameworks and stop measures. Your mother could very well have just been a shadow of herself.
She could have. And I think...
And vanished.
I think, and it's only happened since she passed away, I think that her allowing me to tell her story released her of the shame that she held within her, because she was shameful, literally, I think, until she held that book in her hand. She felt shame of what happened. She blamed herself. I did write this little bit down that I just want to just mention, that she blamed herself for my brother when he was crying and screaming in the room in the Richmond house, and my father came home from work. And it's only a small section in the book. My father slaps my brother, leaves a red mark on his face. My brother's eyes turns in, and my mum the next day has to take him to hospital. My mother, in the book, in her own writing, blames herself for that.
Yeah.
So why would she blame herself? Because she thought it was her fault that the baby cried. And this is what these men do. They make you feel it's gaslighting. It's your fault.
Yeah.
So that's a very small bit in the book. There's lots of tiny bits in the book that if you read it and really think about it, you'll find lots of little hints in the book similar to this.
No, it's a. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because you're right. A lot of, not just women, but victims of abuse in general, whether they're men or women, often blame themselves or find ways to justify what's happening to them and how the other person's behaving. And that's not okay.
No.
And they need to be told it's not okay. They need to be told that you've got their back.
But,
and that there's support for them, that there is, whether it's NGOs or institutions, there is now. Even here in Cyprus, there is support. And it can be an uphill battle, but you've got to find that one person or that one door and ask for help.
Yeah. The other thing is that my mother thought that way back then.
Mm.
Women are still thinking that way today.
Yeah.
So
with all the knowledge that's shared publicly,
they still have the same thought patterns.
Yeah.
I do write in the new book, I take the section, a really pivotal section, and I flip it on its head and I rewrite it in my own way, and I'm sitting down with my mother having a conversation about what happened to her.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen, but I've put that, it's non-fiction turned into fiction in the way it's portrayed. So I'm sitting with my mother, she's 98, and she's telling me the story.
Yeah.
Now, wouldn't it be great if women sat down with somebody they trust and literally told that story of what has been going on behind closed doors? So it doesn't happen. It didn't happen with my mother. I found it in her diary, but I flipped it and write it in a conversation.
Yeah, No, that's beautiful. No, and again, I can only commend you. I can only commend you for what you've done, because it wasn't just your mother that was strong. You were strong to do this.
Thank you.
And I think your son is also strong.
He's very strong. You. Yes, yes.
I'd love to meet your daughter.
she's amazing. She's amazing.
But yeah, I think there is a lot to be said. There's still a long road ahead of us. I do want to mention, just before we wrap up, that men need to learn to help men as well.
Correct.
We live in a world where men are expected to behave a certain way and to tolerate certain things and not question it. Otherwise, you would risk your masculinity or risk condemnation of your other male peers.
Exactly.
And it's time that men became real men, yes, for lack of a better description, and actually stood up to other men and said, enough.
Exactly.
Enough. You know, I want to cry, or I want to have a day off, or I want to spend time with my kids.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm speaking as a father of three girls. The uphill battle I've fought with men and women, mm-hmm, who couldn't comprehend wanting to be flexible with my working conditions to spend time with
you
the kids.
You should be just as women should be.
Yeah. And I thought it's great that there's a lot of movement for adapting to women's needs and, mm-hmm, mothers' needs, but there does need to be at the same, because it's about equality,
exactly,
counterbalancing. You know?
Yes, yes.
And so men also need to have parental leave or working from home conditions or flexi hours to pick up kids from school, mm-hmm, or when kids are sick, sick leave, parental leave.
And to share the sick leave.
Exactly, exactly. And we're not there. There are some countries like in Scandinavia and a little bit New Zealand and somewhat like Victoria, but we're not there yet.
No.
We've got a long way to go before men can help men help women.
Correct, yeah. Well said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're getting there, and the awareness is there. It will probably take a generation, because a lot of things, we're hardwired. Mm-hmm. We have to undo this rewiring our minds, you know, but I think we're going to get there. You're contributing in your way to that.
I'm doing my best. and I did let my son, I said, you can cry, mm-hmm, you can, you know, show your weakness.
Yep.
And he hugs me even in public when he was younger. He was, yep, not ashamed to hug his mum.
I can tell you
or
now.
Or to kiss me.
I see the sons of Cyprus, the lack of affection they have towards,
oh, really,
their parents. Their affection comes out often at the funeral day of their mother.
Wow.
And it's upsetting, because, like, whilst we talk about, for example, the boys of Nicosia as being buttered up boys, you know, like mummy looks after the boys, it's not in reverse. You won't see them giving their mums a hug. You won't see them saying, I love you. The lack of affection, the lack of communication. I'm pleased when I see it among some people. I see it more in Australia than I do, yeah, here. I saw it in your son and his interactions with you, and it was so nice to see, you know, like that it is okay to be human.
Yeah, we've even got a photo of him at the Diaspora Forum where he's actually kissing my forehead.
Yes, yes, yeah. Look, and I must admit, for those listening, that, I mean, I got quite emotional at the award ceremony when your name was read out, and before I saw you,
yeah,
tearing up.
Oh, my God.
I think Leon was the first to tear up.
I think he was.
Yeah,
he said.
And I mean, like, I unfortunately, my photos were terrible of you guys hugging. I just really
think no, useless. I've got one good one.
Yeah, and I'm glad I saw that you got a good one. But, I mean, that bond between the two of you, you got up, and it was like that Academy Awards moment where you cried and he's hugging.
Well, I didn't mean to be like that.
No, it was fantastic. We could have scripted.
I was actually shocked.
You couldn't have scripted it better. No,
except all my photos, my face is all scrunched up.
But I mean, I think there were many wet eyes in that room. You got up and you thanked your mother. You said it was for your mother.
Yeah,
you said
away.
That this is for the women of Cyprus and the world.
It's not for me.
Yeah, and I think the applause.
I can't remember.
No, and I'm sure you can. That's why I want you to hear it from me, because I was there. Yeah, like, it was so well received.
Thank you so much.
And I know that there are going to be people asking. We have discussed this. We're going to arrange a bulk order of the book. So I want people to communicate with me directly, whether it's a comment on the Facebook page or through Island Talks channel, or directly to me at info@constanti.org. Communicate with me, or communicate directly with Helena Kidd, mm-hmm, to order a copy of this book, and we're going to get a batch brought over to Cyprus, because This is a story that needs to be read locally.
Yeah, and I'm so excited because when I started the journey of this book, I had no idea. It was basically to put it out there, yeah. but I didn't know how far it was going to reach. And to bring it back to Cyprus
yes.
has actually just blown me away.
It's a real homecoming.
Yeah, it's and Mum's there.
Yep.
Up there.
Oh, she's having a good chuckle now.
Yeah, she's going, Kitakse.
Yeah.
Ihta spiti.
I did hard work, she gets the credit.
Thank you so much.
I'm looking forward to the next journey that you're going to be on. I'm looking forward to reading the second book. I'm so happy that you've given me a copy. And yeah, like I said, anyone wants to grab a copy of the first book, reach out to me. We're arranging to purchase a batch
yep.
of them. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your stay in Cyprus. Have a safe trip back to Australia when that time comes. I'm looking forward to seeing your next steps.
Next step. And I want to thank you for having me on this wonderful program. I've listened to all your guests and I think they're all amazing.
They are all amazing people.
Thank you for having me here.
Thank you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.